Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Irish novelist Yvonne Cassidy can't pinpoint exactly when she started writing, but says she remembers always making up stories, putting them on pieces of paper, and leaving them all over her house for her parents to find. That house was in the Dublin suburb of Dalkey. While studying business at the National University of Ireland, Yvonne used to talk about the novel she was going to write someday. But it was when she turned 30 that she actually made the move, taking a three-month leave of absence from her job in marketing and writing what she thought was then a first draft. In reality, it was the germ of an idea that over time morphed into The Other Boy. Published in 2010, it was the first of three critically acclaimed novels. It was followed by What Might Have Been Me in 2012, and How Many Letters Are in Goodbye, published in 2014. Yvonne, who moved to New York City in 2011, also writes feature and opinion pieces for Ireland's leading publications and nonfiction pieces for her blog. She's taught creative writing in Ireland and the U.S., and since 2011 has led the creative writing program at Manhattan's Holy Apostles Soup Kitchen, which fosters the talent of homeless and other marginalized writers. Yvonne is also a marketing and communications consultant that includes lecturing, mentoring, and one-on-one training. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sandy. Thanks for asking me to be here.
Was your childhood filled with books?
Absolutely, yeah. I remember when you asked me that question, what comes to mind first is every Saturday we would go to the library, myself and my parents, and it was like the children's library was this prefab building next to like the really nice adults library, and they would go in there and I would go into the prefab building and just spend, you know, kind of a good hour or so looking for books, and then we would all head home with our finds. And
books under your arm.
Books under our arm, yeah, and that would be the reading for the week. And there was loads of books always around the house, and my mum used to do some writing as well, and her typewriter set up at the dining room table, so it was something that was around me from when I was very small.
And you always wanted to write. How did you know you could write? Was this just this feeling that you had something to say, to get out?
I think when I was very small, I remember writing a play. Like, I remember having this, like, I wrote it, I think it was like on the back of some office paper my dad took home from work, and like writing the names and like, you know, the punctuation and the language. And there was something about creating the story that just sort of fascinated me, because I love stories and reading stories. And I think I was young enough that I didn't question, can I do this? I just sort of started doing it, and I knew that I liked it. And then as I got a little bit older into, you know, when I was a teenager, I'm not sure what the curriculum is like over here, but in Ireland, when we have essays to do for exams and things, there's always like the factual ones, you know, which would be like, you know, how Ireland joined the European Union or something like
that. Oh, fascinating.
Fascinating topics. And then there was more creative ones. And I had a very influential English teacher around that time who always encouraged me to do the creative writing essays. And I really loved that. And I remember just getting so lost in creating those stories, and I would get really positive feedback from her, and it was just something that really helped me, I don't know, I'd probably say now connect with myself, but mm-hmm. at the time I wouldn't have had those kind of words. I just knew I liked to do it.
So at that point, as you got older, it was kind of a hobby for you because you didn't major in writing in college.
No, I mean, I did a joint, joint major. I had economics and I had English. And I felt like people used to think that that was a funny combination.
I think it's a funny combination.
It is a funny combination.
The only connection is they both begin with the letter E.
Right. And I think it was, I mean, it's something that sort of shows up even in my life now, that at the time it was like, I loved English, so I wanted to do English. And I felt like economics would help me get a job because I felt like there would be no sort of way to get a job doing
and support
English
yourself.
And support
right.
myself mm-hmm. and all of that. By majoring in both of those things, when it came to the English piece of it, I think I thought there would be more creative writing as part of that. And there wasn't really. I mean, it was a lot of reading and a lot of, you know, critiquing and all of that. So I wasn't writing as much then as I certainly had been at school.
Which is fascinating because the history of Irish writers is so rich and varied. That seems almost a shame.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think now, you know, would it not be more part of the curriculum, or at least have extracurricular things? And I mean, maybe there were. Maybe I was just very immersed in my college life and hanging out with my friends. Maybe I didn't notice there was other opportunities around. But certainly on the core curriculum, it was very much sort of learning based and exam focused. And all the essays were about other people's writing. There wasn't really a creative writing focus.
So at that point, that was OK with you, I suppose, because you were heading in another direction.
I mean, yes and no. I felt for me when I sort of graduated college and finished up that the only direction really that was available or sort of supported was to go down the business route and into the business world.
Even though you're female?
Yeah, even though I'm female. I mean, it was like, unless I wanted to be a teacher or something like that, which I sort of had toyed with that idea, you know, which, you know, if any teachers of mine were listening to this, they'd probably find ironic because I used to sometimes get in trouble in school. But I did think about, you know, the teaching thing for about 2 minutes. And then it was like, no, the business world was sort of where there was money to be made. And that was the thing. So that, you know, I moved to London right after college. That's what I did. But there was always this part of me that was like, I'm going to write a novel someday. Like, I'll get back to that, you know, and I never fully left that behind.
As you got closer to 30, that fire started to burn brighter?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, during my 20s, I would sort of what I would consider like dabble, you know, I would do like writing courses at night. And I loved that. I remember being when I was in London, I signed up to this writing course. It was on a Thursday night in Hammersmith. And I remember just the joy of reconnecting with writing in that way. It was my favorite thing in the week. I would look forward to it no matter what was happening at work or how stressful it was. I would make that class. And for, you know, the hour and a half or however long it was, I would be totally focused on writing. And it was just, it was wonderful. I was sort of a serial class taker through my 20s. And as I was doing that, my career took off. I moved back to Dublin and I was working for a cell phone company there, and it was the Celtic Tiger, and everybody was working very hard and very long hours and all of that. It was a funny time because it was like more of my physical energy and mental energy was going towards my career. But more and more, I just felt like something was
missing.
Your heart. Something in my heart was missing. I'm seeing myself gesturing to my heart.
Right.
And as I kind of approached 30, I think it was like, you know, sounds sort of dramatic, and maybe it felt dramatic at the time, but I thought, well, I've been talking about this novel.
Shut up already.
Yeah, just shut up and write it. You know, on my gravestone, do I want to be like either she tried and failed? Okay, well, that's one thing, but I don't want to be she never tried at all.
Yeah, she talked about it.
Yeah, she talked about it a lot.
But you had the seed of something in your head, or you had no idea what it was you were going to write. You just knew that there was a novel in you, but it wasn't very defined.
It was definitely that it wasn't very defined. And that sort of, I think, really held me back because I had this idea that, you know, sitting down to write a novel, that it must be fully formed. You know, you would know what the story was. There would be such a drive to tell the story.
I would think.
That's what I thought. And I didn't have that. And it was in one of the writing classes that I went to, I guess it was sort of late in my 20s. I was probably 28, 29. That the focus was really on the character. And we focus so much on like getting into character and the idea that once you find the right character, you can follow them into the story. And to a certain extent, they will sort of show you the story. Mm-hmm. And we did this writing exercise in that class. She was a great teacher. And she used to take in the side of the Irish Times at the time, I don't know if it's still there, but there used to be these really short little synopsis stories, like just like a headline and probably like 60 words. Mm-hmm. And she would give us these and we would take them in as writing prompts. And I took one of them.
Flush them out,
exactly. And I took one of them and wrote a couple scenes. And it was this, about these two brothers. And the scene was like, the story was about there had been a break-in or something to some house. And what I was writing about was these two brothers. And one of them was kind of a reluctant participant, and one of them was like really the leader, and I just kind of got interested in this relationship between them, and those two brothers actually became the characters,
the basis,
what became my first novel,
which is The Other Boy.
That's right.
So what a great segue. So talk about that book and the process of writing it. I'm not going to be naive enough to ask, was it easy? Did it just pour out of you?
I would love to say, oh, it just poured out of me and that was it. As you mentioned in the beginning, I took 3 months off from my job. So when I got that time, I went to London because I felt like I needed some sort of physical, geographical shift, you know, just out of sort of the day to day. And plus the book was set in London. So it felt like a nice excuse to go and stay with a friend who wanted to stay in London. So I stayed with her for about a month of the 3 months. And I wrote every day. And I went to the library. I went to the British Library. And I'm a big advocate of libraries. I'm not a good person for writing at home.
Too many distractions.
I think for me to feel like it's a job, I need to get up and get out and get somewhere.
Yeah.
So I would go to the library and I would show up and I would be there every day. And then when I got back to Dublin, I did the same thing. I went to the library at UCD where I was at college and did that. And so by the end of this 3 months, I had 140,000 words or something. I mean, it was, you know, I was like, wow, this is my novel, you know. And I would just write scene by scene, you know, and these scenes were sort of coming. I didn't really plot a lot. I had a sense of a plot, but, you know, I wasn't a big plotter. And I felt like really good about it. And then after what happened then, I got back to work. And after a couple months, a friend of mine put me in touch with an agent in London. And she, her name was Grainne Fox, who now works actually over here. I sent her a couple of chapters of the book and she sent me back this email. I remember I got it on my birthday. And the email,
I get the feeling it wasn't a great present.
Well, actually, the email initially was, because the first line in the email was like, I loved these chapters. You know, I loved what I read and I want to talk to you on the phone. So that was like, you know, I'm thinking, okay, this is like now my 31st birthday. This is going to be the best present ever, right?
Yeah.
So when we spoke on the phone, which was a few days later, her opening line was like, I love your writing style and I love the characters and I love the story.
But?
And right, the next 40 minutes was spent with her telling me what was wrong with it and why it didn't work and what I would need to do and all the things with it, you know, that were problematic. And that was, I mean, that was hard. That was very hard to hear, I think, coming from my sort of expectation of, well, this is sort of done now to this. And it took a little while. I mean, it took a little while to
kind of... For the sting to dissipate?
Right, yeah. I definitely, I think, felt stung by it. Even at the time, I think intellectually, some part of me knew for this person to spend this much time with me going through this, you know, there's something here.
Exactly.
You know,
she wouldn't have wasted it. Yeah,
right.
On
and
you.
I remember somebody saying that to me, but I couldn't take that in for a little while. I could know it, but not really feel it. So it took a few months before I was able to kind of, you know, get back on the horse and really take it out and look at it. And I could see, I could see
that she was right.
She was right in what she had said. So I signed up for yet another writing class, which actually became more like a writing group. And I stayed there for a good few years. And I started to just really work on the story and on the draft and what was it that this story was about. And I kind of had to ditch a lot of it. I had to write new things. And every week I would bring a chapter into this class, this group, and they worked it through with me. And it was so helpful. I was at a place where I knew what I wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that like, you know, I've brought stuff to classes where it's been too early and I've gotten people's input when I don't want it.
Got it.
But this was at a stage where I felt robust enough that these people's help was just amazing. And I kept doing that. And then about, I guess, 2 years later, by this time I had left the job and I was doing consulting freelance work on my own. I had what actually was a finished novel.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Irish novelist Yvonne Cassidy, and we're talking about the first book she ever wrote, which was called The Other Boy. Where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea came from initially from
the little article. Right.
Yeah.
But then how did that morph into something much larger?
I think for me, the idea was like, because the article was about these two brothers who'd been involved in crime.
Right.
And I'm an only child. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I was very drawn to and have been very drawn to writing about sibling relationships. Mm-hmm. And this idea, I mean, in a way, I think the central idea of the novel is about how the brothers experienced their childhood and how different it was. And JP, who's the main character, has this very sort of idealized version or memory of his childhood, and particularly his relationship with their father. Mm-hmm. And Desi, who is the older brother, has a very, very different view of both that relationship and growing up. And so when the book opens, JP is living in London. He has this sort of, you know, quote unquote, perfect life. He has the girl, he has the job, they're having a baby. And Desi, who's been in prison, comes back into his life and really sort of unsettles everything and forces JP to look at things that he didn't really want to look at or that he had sort of not thought about in a long time. So I think this central idea of like what we remember, how we remember, who's right. You know, if I can talk to friends of mine about something that happened years ago and we'll all remember different things.
Absolutely.
You know, that sort of trying to get at that in fiction. It was fun for me to sort of play around with that idea. And JP is the central character, so we see everything through his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not the most reliable narrator, as we sort of discover going through the book. And so I found that fun, you know, this idea of the double vision of my narrator, but of what the reader is also seeing and how to kind of peel that back as I got further into the novel.
So it was relatively well received.
Yes, it was.
So that was clearly a catalyst for you to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That kind of emboldens you propels you to the next step, which is the next book, What Might Have Been Me.
Yeah.
Explain the genesis of this novel.
Okay. So What Might Have Been Me, I felt like that sort of that central question, you know, that I have had, you know, and I think maybe other people have had, like if I had taken this road or if I had done this thing or, you know, how would things have ended up if I had made a different decision? And Carla, who's the main character in What Might Have Been Me, made a decision when she was very young, in her early 20s, to stay in New York illegally. And she did what a lot of me and my peers did. A lot of Irish people come over and work in the States for a summer when we're in college. And we all used to go out to Montauk, and that was like what we did. And there was always like this sort of the urban legend of the girl who met someone who never came back, you know, and we all came back to college and did the thing and finished the thing and went and got jobs. It was like, wow, what would that have been like, you know, to kind of
if we weren't
be her?
So boring.
Exactly. If we weren't feeling like our parents would go crazy if we didn't come home.
Sure.
So Carla kind of became that girl. And
that fantasy for you?
In a sense, maybe a fantasy, but maybe more just a kind of an exploring of kind of what that would have been like. One of the themes in my books is I like to write about characters who get stuck in certain points for, you know, for different reasons, because, you know, I think we can all get stuck. I know I can get stuck. And what happens with Carla is because she's illegal over here, it's fine to be illegal, 20, 21, you're working in a bar, you're waiting tables, whatever. But as she's getting on towards 30, you know, she's stuck. And
oh, gee, did somebody start writing a novel when they were 30?
You're seeing a little parallel here going on. Exactly. So there's that kind of story. And then meanwhile, back in Ireland, her sister, because again, I like writing about siblings, her sister is caring for her mother, who's just been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's.
Swell.
So life is really joyous over there. So she has this decision to make about whether she's going to go back, whether she's going to stay. She's in a relationship over here, which is not really working out so well. So there's sort of all these things that are happening. So I guess the title really kind of relates to how she becomes the Carla she wants to be.
Did book number two come easily to you? And what was the gap between the two?
I don't know if I would say it came easily. I think the thing that I learned and I have learned between the process of writing those books and even what I'm working on now is the ability to follow my intuition.
Huh.
If there's a part of me that's saying, you know, write this. Mm-hmm. Just if something comes into my mind, even if I don't get it, even if I don't know where it fits, even if it doesn't seem like it does fit, don't question that. That's a little gift right there, and just go with it. And I think that certainly with What Might Have Been Me, that I did that more. And part of What Might Have Been Me is set in New York. And at that time, I was working as a consultant, which meant I could, you know, create my own schedule a bit more. And I would come over to New York and I would get an apartment in Brooklyn and I would take time to write. And I remember the first time I did that, you know, there was a big part of me that was like, right, we're here, we have a month, we got to really do this, get going, mm-hmm. you know, like get into the library. And there was this other part that was like, actually, no, not yet. Let's wander. Mm-hmm. Let's, you know, wander around Williamsburg. And I allowed myself to follow that part of me more and just trust that that was taking me towards something. And, you know, and not that I wasn't writing, I was writing, but this like sitting down and, you know, at 1500 words a day, that was going to come at another point.
So you really were not very hard on yourself. And I mean that in a positive
right.
way.
No, I mean, I have fun with it. I enjoy it. And I have
you
to.
You like to write.
I love to write. And it's like, it's kind of like playing. It's like that part of me that is the creative part that finds the stories is having fun and is playing with it. And if I become overly critical or hard or whatever, it's like that part's not going to play with me anymore. So, you know, I've got to let that happen.
Did you ever worry that the first book was an aberration?
No.
Never?
No.
And you knew you had other stories and another book in you.
Yeah, I did. I
You don't seem tortured.
The most tortured part was when I finished The Other Boy and I got an agent really quickly, which was like, you know,
unheard
fantastic
of.
And mm-hmm. unheard of and all those things. And she was very excited and she started to put out the submissions to all the publishers. And then the rejections started to come. And that part was very, very difficult because, you know, there was this what felt like it went on forever. I mean, in reality, it was probably 6 or 7 or 8 months mm-hmm. where it felt like nearly every Friday I was getting her send me through. I was having her send me through a rejection. And it seemed like, you know, the editors were clearing their desks. And these were often long rejections. And she would say they're really positive rejections.
But what the hell? There's an oxymoron
right.
if I ever heard one.
Right, right. You know, there was some editor who said, you know, she went to bed thinking they were going to make me an offer and she couldn't sleep. And all night she twisted and turned. And the next morning she thought, no, it's not right. You know, and I was always almost like, I don't want to know that it was that close. I'd rather that it was just...
Yeah, no. It was awful.
You know?
Yeah.
So around that time, that was the hardest time. And I hadn't been writing. I had finished The Other Boy. I wasn't writing. And I knew I needed to start writing something else. Uh-huh. And the idea for What Might Have Been Me was sort of there. And it was in bits of pieces of notes and stuff. And I started to write it. And that immediately made me feel better. And I had this post-it note that I kept on my fridge for years. I don't even know where it is now. I'm sure I threw it away. But it was like to remind me, it said, you know, you can't control the publishing process, editors, agents, what anyone thinks. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can control is the quality you put into your work. And I just tried to stick with that. Really integrate it and feel like, and I did, I felt like The Other Boy was never going to be published. I felt like that was going to be the book where I cut my teeth mm-hmm. and learned how to write a novel. And so be it. Mm-hmm. And my job was to work on writing my next book and just do my best with that next book. And I felt that I would continue to write books even if nobody ever published them, that I was writing for me.
So that brings us to how many letters are in Goodbye. So what's the distance between that book and What Might Have Been Me? How many years?
So What Might Have Been Me came out January 2012.
Which was 20 minutes ago,
really. Right. And How Many Letters Are In Goodbye came out in June 2014. So,
which is 10 minutes ago.
Right, right. So they're all very close together.
That's crazy.
That's how
Yvonne.
I feel. I hope my publisher is listening. Because I'm slow for them. Yeah.
Wow.
They have this model, you know, and I understand it. I worked and worked in marketing too, you know, where they're establishing a brand. You've got a reader base.
Carpe diem.
Absolutely. They want things to get out there quickly. And, you know, and there's a cycle where the trade paperback comes out and then the paperback comes out. And, you know, you don't want to let too much time lag. So that is definitely a pressure. I mean, you asked about, you know, me being kind of nice to myself and having fun. I mean, that's the other part of it. And certainly in like second draft stuff, it can get very heavy and very time draining. And every moment can be spent, weekends, evenings, you know, and it can be hard to balance with every mm-hmm. other thing. So How Many Letters Are In Goodbye? I guess I started that around 2012. Yeah, I moved here October 2011. And I probably started How Many Letters probably in about March 2012, so not long after What Might Have Been Me had come out. Mm-hmm. And that book, that's been a completely different process for me. The book is told through letters. And my main character, Rhea, who's much younger than my other characters, she's 17, she turns 18 in the novel. She's writing to her mom. And her mom died when she was three, so she never really knew her mom. And when the book opens, Rhea is homeless on the streets of New York, and she sort of has no one to turn to. So she does this thing that she used to do when she was a little kid. Her and her dad would write letters to her mom.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the story unfolds for the reader. It's also how the story unfolded for me. In like, I feel like I'm learning as I go through. Well, what I feel like I'm being told a story. It's not like I'm figuring out the story. It's almost in a way like this. Through sitting down, showing up, writing these letters, my characters are showing me the story, which I'm aware might sound like I'm a crazy person.
No, but actually, it sounds fascinating. This connection that you're making with them was not established before.
Right.
You're both on this journey.
Yes.
The writer and the characters.
Yeah.
And that also was well received.
Yes. Yeah, that was well received. That was my first LGBT character, too. So that was kind of a big thing
for
me.
So that was that personal?
I mean, in a sense, it was. I mean, my own sort of personal journey between, like, the books, a lot had been kind of happening in my own life, mm-hmm. including coming out and mm-hmm. being comfortable with my own sexuality mm-hmm. and getting married and all this stuff. So it sort of was a natural thing. It felt like that it was going to come out in the book. And I felt like I didn't want it to be a book about, this is about a girl coming to terms with her sexuality, but I wanted
much
that to be a strand of the book,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think sometimes with like, it can be like, oh, this is lesbian fiction,
right,
and this is like, you know, contemporary fiction over here. And it's like, well, why can't a lesbian story just be part, why can't that just be part
both.
Of the story
sure.
rather than the whole story or
right.
the definition? So I sort of wanted to do that.
So what's number four?
Number four feels like my most challenging book yet. I mean, a friend of mine who is also a writer said to me, you know, wow, well, I'm sure after doing the letters thing, it's going to be fun, you know, to relief to come back to just a straight sort of narrative. And I was like, yeah, well, if I was coming back to a straight narrative, it might feel like that. This book four has two different characters in it.
What's it called?
I'm Right Here.
Okay.
Is the working title of the book. And the idea of what I'm writing at the moment, there are two characters in completely different timelines, essentially. So there's a young girl who's living in Brooklyn Heights, who's, you know, in a contemporary time. It's like 2013, 14. And then I have a character who is a young girl who is a slave on a cotton plantation.
In the South?
In the South.
Wow.
In Charleston.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, in the 1850s. So there's the story is sort of the story of these two young girls. Who
parallel lives.
Parallel. Like, it couldn't, in a sense, their lives couldn't be more different,
uh-huh.
but there's a connection point between them. And yeah, and so I'm writing both of their stories. I'm writing their connection with each other. It's the first time I've done anything historical.
Wow.
You know, there's a bit of a leap in terms of, you know, how the connection point happens. So I'm sort of working with that too.
But that's what's really great, because you're a risk taker.
Right. There's no way I would have been able to write this book or take it on as my first or second book. And I feel like what I've learned through the others is like, even at times when it's like, why am I writing this book? This isn't my story. You know, who am I to be writing about slavery, some, you know, Irish girl or whatever? What
right.
do I have to say
sure.
and all that? So when those voices get really loud, I sort of just try and quell it with the following of this intuition, which has always sort of worked in the past, that there's a reason that I'm writing this. And I think having the two characters almost is my way in, because the young girl in Brooklyn, it's not her story either. You know, she's like, well, why am I, you know, why do I have this connection with this girl and this past? And, you know, this doesn't make sense to me. But that's sort of part of the story.
I can't believe that we've just about run out of time, but I just wanted to end on the fact that what you've done for yourself, you now share with other people because
right.
you teach writing. That must
yeah.
also be wonderful. And especially
yeah.
for marginalized and homeless people, giving them a voice and encouragement and an outlet must really get you to sleep at night.
I absolutely love teaching. I mean, I just get such a lot out of it, you know, and I teach at Holy Apostle Soup Kitchen. I teach at other places. And recently I've been doing some writing coaching. And it just feels like such a privilege to be able to work with somebody on their writing and to, you know, be able to share what I've learned to help them. And for me, finding my voice was such a part of it, you know, because
mm-hmm.
in the beginning, I didn't realize it, but I was like imitating other writers that I liked,
mm-hmm.
or I was writing so people might think that it was good or, you know, that it was clever.
Wasn't sincere enough for
right.
you.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't. And being able to kind of create environments in classes where people feel, you know, safe enough and comfortable enough and having enough fun to do that. And particularly within the homeless community where, you know, it can be very isolating for people, and to see the impact that that has on them, not just me as a teacher in the class, but with their peers and
sure.
the other students. It's, yeah, it's really, really
That's
special.
That's fabulous.
It's really special.
Well, Yvonne Cassidy, I wish we could go on and on because I think we could, but I really want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank
You're
you,
terrific.
Sandy.
Lots of luck.
Thank you.
Just go in the corner and keep on plugging away at the computer.
Thank you very much, Sandy. It was a pleasure being here.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.